as I just said, the focus for these 6 weeks is the field, but in the TSK reading that we're doing, so this is the second week in which we've really focused on the first book, the TSK book, the whole concept or notion or approach that relies on the field, that's not developed in the first book. So actually, one of the things that I've found interesting, and especially for people who are in the teacher training, I think it's worth pointing out, the kind of corresponding image that is used in the first book is that of a focal setting, and that's what's talked about here. And I'm not saying that talking about focal settings is exactly the same as talking about fields, but there is a relationship between the two, and we'll talk about that a little more later on. And it's just interesting sometimes to see how does a theme that comes up in one book relate to presentations in other books. So one of the reasons that I like to work with field, or one of the, I shouldn't say it that way, one of the benefits, it seems to me, is as we've been working with space as a field and that whole approach, apart from just the fact that it seems to me a very powerful way of engaging space, and I like it a lot. But apart from that is that it also gives us a chance to work with knowledge of time and space. Now, that book has actually been translated into Portuguese. It has not been translated into German or Dutch, where our other centers are located. So in Brazil, people have a kind of an advantage there. But in general, knowledge of time and space is a difficult book to engage. Partly it's just so long, people are scared when they pick it up. And partly it offers a lot of different approaches and it doesn't exactly have a straight momentum, a kind of a linear unfolding. And so it's hard for people to know how to engage with it. But this whole theme of a field is very beautifully presented, it seems to me, in Knowledge of Time and Space. And although it comes up in Dynamics also, this is really the most comprehensive presentation. So it's a good place to work with that book, in terms of teaching. And another interesting thing that we will get to actually in two sessions from now, two classes from now, is that the idea of a field comes up twice, or kind of an extended treatment comes up twice in Knowledge of Time and Space. We've been working with the first set, the first treatment, and then we'll go in week six, we will look at the second time it gets discussed, which is in a somewhat different context. So those are all interesting things. It seems to me, and there are benefits that come when you get to work with this material. So now I want to go into the content. Let me say one more thing about that, and that is that this week we're reading TSK, and next week we'll be reading TSK. So we actually are going to spend 3 weeks out of the six working with material from TSK, and then 3 weeks working with materials from Knowledge of Time and Space, and hopefully it will all feel coherent by the time we're done. It seems to me coherent. And maybe one more practical thing, a reminder again about letting us know about attending the retreat, which is June 7th through 11th, I think we decided. That's important. We appreciate it. I know Ken had a question about that, which I will answer. The reading starts as a kind of commentary on exercises 11 through 13. So this is the reading pages 63 to 68 of TSK. So it starts with a commentary to those exercises. And of course, we didn't do them for this week. We did do them about 2 months ago. Those were assigned in the previous session. So I'm just going to go ahead and make the assumption that you have some sense, if you've gone back and looked at them, what is really involved here. It has to do with thoughts and space between thoughts and space within thoughts. And one of the reasons that that's important, and one of the things that's very strongly presented in this reading is the relationship between mind and space. You know, this reading comes up in the space part of the TSK book, and yet it's almost entirely focused on mind. And one of the things we'll look at is why is that a legitimate approach? You know, most people would not connect mind and space. So the short answer to that, and actually I don't have a lot more to say than this, but the short answer to that is that mind, like space, allows. The quality of mind, the kind of distinguishing characteristic, is that it allows appearance. It allows, you know, everything that shows up for us is possible because of mind. In the same way, you could say that everything that shows up for us is possible because of space. And that's just the reverse side, really, of what Rinpoche says, I think, on page 64. When this sentence that is set off from the rest of the text, where he says, mind, like space, has no foundation. In other words, there's nothing substantial about mind. That's a little bit oversimplified, but there's nothing substantial about mind, just as there's nothing substantial about space. And it's because there's nothing substantial that there's no barrier to appearance. If you had substance, then it just is not the case that everything could appear. But if you don't have substance, then the possibility is there of allowing without limitation, allowing without reservation. So that's the basic connection. And you might say, well, okay, so space is a good metaphor for mind, but it really goes deeper than that. The fundamental nature of mind and the fundamental nature of space are being presented here as one and the same. And coming at that in terms of the field, I think, is a very good way of understanding why that's so. So we're going to use some of that field understanding as we talk today, even though we are really, you know, the reading doesn't talk about it in terms of field. Okay, so the starting point of the reading is challenging the mind as the generator or source for experience. So it may sound that as though that contradicts what I just said, because I just said, well, mind allows everything. So aren't we saying, well, mind is the source of everything that appears? And the answer is, you know, let's take the text seriously. The answer is no. That's not what it means to say that mind allows everything. To say that mind is the source is to make a very different kind of claim. So let's look at that claim, because that's really the heart of what's going on in this reading. And it isn't spelled out that clearly, I don't think. That's not a criticism of the book. It's just, I'm going to try to put it in a different way, let's say, to help clarify what's at stake. If mind is the source, let's imagine, you know, the opposite, and we say mind is the source, that would mean that mind was some kind of an entity that had the capacity or the power to cause experience. That really flatly contradicts the notion that mind has no foundation, that mind is, that mind, like space, has the capacity to allow, because when you have an object or an entity, a substance of some kind, whether it's the objects that we see around us or the thoughts that we identify and label, or the emotions, or the mind as a source, which is just in the background, any of those examples, and you could, you know, we are always relying on a kind of an object-oriented way of thinking about things, so the number of examples just goes on and on and on and on. But in this case, we're looking at the example of mind as a particular kind of entity that has the capacity to cause experience, to be that mind is the source of experience. And taking that view then commits us to the understanding of objects and subjects. So the mind is a particular kind of entity which is closely related to the self, the subject, and what the nature of that relationship is, I think, is really problematic. It's not something that's talked about here, so we won't talk about it too much. But you know, we like to say that we have a mind, but at the same time, it seems as though the mind is the one that is responsible for all of our experience. So then where does that put us? Are we just kind of the outside observer in the mind? Or, you know, this issue has come up, of course, with in Western thought, it's sometimes talked about as the Cartesian theater, because Descartes talks about mind, but what he really thinks he's established is the existence of the self. And if you put that model together to try to make sense out of it, and in fact there are drawings that I think Descartes did or had done, which show the self as this little man inside the mind, you know, the observer in the Cartesian theater. That's the way that image has come along. So mind is not quite the same thing as the self, but is very intimately related. And as I say, that's kind of problematic what the relationship is. But for our purpose, it doesn't really matter. You could say, well, the self is a certain kind of thing. It's the kind of thing that has the capacity to know, which means that it's involved with the mind. Or you could say the mind is a certain kind of thing. But you've got the mind thing over here as the source, because in order to be a source, it has to be some kind of substance, it has to have some kind of identity. And then you've got all the things that show up in experience. And so you end up with what the text on, not in this reading, but on page 61, it refers to the a subject-object fragmentation. You end up with a view in which there are just things, and space has disappeared. Space is what's, you know, space is when there's nothing there. But in fact, all of our experience is about the things that show up. Space just, you know, we need it, but it's not, there's no way of engaging it. That's, again, one reason why the field view is so helpful, because now we have a way of engaging space. So when you have a subject-object fragmentation, to use that language, you've got things in space, but you don't know space. And, you know, because there's nothing there, there's nothing to know, there's nothing to take hold of. And interestingly, really there is nothing, you don't really know objects, and you don't really know the mind. You end up in this position of great ignorance. So let me say a little more about why I would say that, because you might think, well, but we do know objects. That's the whole point. That's why we think the mind is so important, because it lets us have experiences and know objects and so on. The problem is that what the mind knows is really the surface of objects or experiences. So the one good way to think about that is in terms of seeing. And of course, we rely on our other senses and we rely on thought. But seeing is such an important sense for us. And the thing about seeing is it really only ever sees the surface of things. Right? So if you have an orange in front of you, let's say, then you see the surface of the orange. Now if you say, well, I want to get to the inside of the orange, so you cut it open. And now you can say, I'm seeing the inside of the orange, but you're still only seeing a surface. Now you're seeing the surface of the inside of the orange. And if you, you know, if you look in a microscope, you still are only seeing the surface of what you see. There is a sense that there's a thing there, and you have access to the surface of it. And underneath that surface, there's some the thingness of it, but you don't ever contact that, right? you stay at a distance, and from a distance, and that's why the image of the Cartesian theater is helpful. From a distance, you don't know the thing itself. You only know what appears. So Sudhi's commenting on that. She says, we know the object through our separating from it, not becoming one with it, or from a radiant way of knowing. Yeah, that's right. So I'm not sure exactly what you have in mind with a radiant way of knowing, although that certainly has a flavor that goes well with TSK. But definitely not becoming one with it. So you know, one way to think about that, or an image for thinking about that, is, and this is very much like the Cartesian theater image, imagine you're watching a horse race. And so you see it from a distance, and you can very clearly describe what's going on. You say this horse is ahead, and now this horse is ahead, and so on. That's completely different from being down in the middle of the race. You know, you're the jockey sitting on the horse's back, and all around you are these other horses, and there's noise, and there's breathing, and the dirt, and all of that's going on. And we all have a little bit of a sense of that because, you know, movies are very good at letting us enter into a world that we don't usually know. But in fact, our experience of the horse race, you know, unless we really are in the world of horse racing, is going to be from watching it from a distance. And we're not one with it. So if you were in the race, that's kind of a model or an image for really being one with it, being in the middle of it. That's really what I'm saying. When if the mind is the source, then there's this mind source and there's this thing known, and there's a distance between them. And in that whole model, distance and separation and subject-object fragmentation are always in operation. That limits our ability to know. So that's why I said there was this kind of fundamental ignorance at work in this model, which says that the mind is the source. One image for thinking about that, which I've found helpful, and I know Rinpoche's, he doesn't use it in this context, but he's interested in this, is the notion of black holes in outer space, you know, that at the center of many stars or galaxies or different places in the universe, you find these black holes. And the thing about black holes is the pull of gravity is so intense that nothing can escape them. And so if you wanted to apply that analogy, and as I said, Rinpoche doesn't do this, but I have found it helpful to think this way. You could say that the gravity of identity, and we did talk about gravity a couple of weeks ago and the gravity of thinking, so I'm just really applying that image. The gravity of identity is so strong that it creates this blackness, this place where we can't see. And that's true whether it's the identity of the mind as source, or mind as knower, you could say, or the objects that we experience. So Sudhi continues with, she wants to explain what she meant by a radiant way of knowing. Radiant way being when unknowingly the knower has dropped away. I like that unknowingly in there. Okay. I like the word radiant because one of the things that it suggests is a kind of a no-source view, which is very much what Rinpoche also suggests in this part of TSK, and it's exactly the opposite of what he's talking about here when he talks about the mind as being the source of experience. In a no-source view, knowledge is just available. The allowing, talking about mind now and mind allowing appearance or experience, the knowing of that allowing is available everywhere. So it's radiating throughout space, you could say. And again, that takes us in the direction of a field. Because in a field, it's not the source. You don't worry about the source. Maybe you say there is a source of the field, but the field itself, there's an energy there, which is available throughout the field. Maybe more intense in some places than others. You know, I don't want to push the image too far, but that's part of what, why a field understanding is so important. So, so Michael says, sort of playing on this, or playing with this, in the radiant way of knowing, the Cartesian theater has no actors, only puppets, no dress rehearsals, only performances. I like that. Being in the middle means we can see that everything arises without a director or a script. Right. Or, you know, my only hesitation with that, I think that's very nicely put. My only hesitation is maybe we don't want to say we can see something. You know, it's more that when we're in the middle, there is no director and there is no script. There's a nice passage that I've used before in a novel I read once that talks about stories. And it says when you're in the middle of a story, there really isn't any story. There's just this kind of chaos whirling around you. And it's only afterwards when you look back at it, or we might say it's only from outside when you look at it, that you see these connections that let you say, oh, that's the story. When you're in the middle of it, I don't think it has to be chaotic, but it's alive, and maybe better to talk about radiance than chaos, let's say that. Karen says, thinking this through is making us feel not safe. Don't we need this safeness, this safety for our identity? Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think the point comes up in TSK. People sometimes have the reaction of feeling a little bit threatened, like the usual structure, the usual model is under stress. You know, we're saying no. Our, you know, this identity, this we need that to feel secure, because it supports our identity. So I'm going to give you a theoretical answer and then maybe a more practical answer. The theoretical answer is that only matters for, you know, when you're concerned about identity. If you can give up the concern with identity, which is exactly what we're talking about really in this no-source view, then it's not an issue. It just doesn't become an issue. But the practical question is, and I think this is more what you're asking, is, you know, you say, yes, if I can give up my identity, then I don't need to worry. I don't, you know, I'm not concerned about the safety of myself. But in fact, I feel very engaged with this identity. So what do I do about that? You know, or another way of saying that is just, you know, in fact, I feel threatened. I don't feel safe if I think this way. So I think one of the characteristics of the TSK vision is that it doesn't really attack things in that way. It doesn't attack our identity. And Rinpoche says this specifically in different places. It just says, what if you see things differently? You know, what if your vision of reality was different? So the shift in vision that we're talking about here is a shift away from an object-centered way of seeing, and which is identity-centered, to a field-centered way of seeing. And you could talk in terms of focal setting. That's what this reading does. But let's just stay with fields for now. We're shifting to a field-centered way of being. And in the field, if that's your vision, then the issue of identity really doesn't arise. And it's not because you have to make a transition or you have to give up your sense of identity. It's just that it doesn't arise in the same way. So the exercises are, and the reading, are intended to allow for those possibilities to emerge and really in a gentle way. I think it's fair to say that TSK wants to take a very gentle approach, and it's saying, you know, don't get rid of anything, don't reject anything, just try seeing differently, you know, try activating this different vision, and then those concerns won't come up. Are there, you know, do people sometimes get a sense of something threatening? yeah, I mean, I've had people say that. But we're trying to go in a way where that just, that doesn't arise, that particular problem. Okay, so I'm going to, I don't think I'll go into that. Yes. Well, that's good. And this is a point that gets made in the TSK teachings that, you know, any kind of reaction that you have. So, confusion and not knowing, that's one place that Rinpoche really emphasizes that, but also being threatened, is, a manifestation. So you said Hayward as a way of knowing, and I think that's good. That is fundamentally the right way to think about it. And it leads, let me just use that as a kind of transition to the what it seems to me to be a very central point here, which is that if you don't have a source from understanding, that's what Rinpoche is suggesting here, is the possibility of engaging the world without, you know, taking the mind as being the source of our experience. And it might sound like that's not such a big deal, but I think we're seeing from our discussion that it's a very important shift. So if you don't have that shift, then you find yourself in the field of awareness. Right? There's no source, but whatever it is that you're aware of is available. You know, there's this great allowing, and the thoughts and the feelings that show up are all in the field. They don't belong to a self. They aren't generated by a mind. They aren't with regard to a particular object. All those structures are really no longer calling the shots, you know, are no longer determining the way things are. Instead, there's this complete availability, and there's a quality of awareness and knowing that is just naturally radiating in the field. And then, as Hayward says, whatever shows up, and it may be the sense of feeling threatened or not safe, is also something that's available within the field. It's when identity comes up. You know, it may be that, I mean, for there to be a sense of threat, presumably there has to be some sense of identity under threat, because if there were no identity, there'd be nothing to be threatened. But if the feeling of threat comes up and you're able to see that as something manifesting in the field, kind of have a field awareness, it's not going to be an issue. Okay, Michael says something about this. He says, perhaps identity is like a comfortable pair of shoes, good for walking on thorny ground, but an unnecessary encumbrance when swimming in the great ocean of a realm without edges. Well, again, a very nice image. And I think that's actually, that seems to me to say something important about the difference between a field-centered awareness and our usual object-centered awareness. It's like the difference between being, you know, walking on the ground and encountering things and swimming in the ocean, or you might also say flying in the air. You know, the ocean or the atmosphere are more like a field, which seems right. Whereas being on the ground is this kind of encountering things, you know, a steady range of encounters. And it actually reminds me of the beginning of the, the opening paragraph of the TSK book, where it says something like, you know, wherever we go, whatever we do on this crowded surface of interactions that we call the world, above us is the sky. So that's the distinction that's being made, you know, is yes, in our ordinary daily interactions, we are always we are a person, a someone, encountering things in the world, but the sky is always available. That field awareness, I'm going to say right now, is always available. Okay, well, let's see if we can maybe explore that with a practice. Well, before I, let me just say one more thing about that, and then we'll do a practice. We'll have time. So the thing I wanted to say is just to connect that up to what is said in the reading. You know, it's not about fields, it's about focal setting. What Rinpoche says, let's see if I can find the place where he talks about focal setting. So one place is on page 65 in the last full paragraph. He says, great space. So great space. And I don't think field awareness is great space. I mean, in fact, you know, that's said very specifically, I think, in Knowledge of Time and Space. We don't need to worry right now about the distinction. But in any event, he's saying a more encompassing understanding of space. Let's just leave it at that. Great space does not stand in a two-term relation to its manifestations. So the ordinary view is things in space, and space is separate from the things that show up in space, even though space also pervades whatever shows up in it. That's our ordinary understanding. In this understanding, if you say space is field, just to take that in-between position, what shows up in the field is the field. You know, the field really is comprised of everything that shows up within it without limiting it by the kind of identity of the things that show up. That, you know, that would be going back to an ordinary way of understanding. The field is the kind of furthest extension of everything that shows up within the field. There really is no separation. That's what he's saying here. He says, that's great space. Then he says, ordinary mind does stand in such a relation to its thoughts, or you could say to the things that we identify and encounter in the world. Right? And then he talks about mind as focal setting, that way of understanding. He says that's midway between the two. It's other than the thoughts. In other words, it's other than the things that show up in the mind or the things that show up in our experience. But it's not locatable elsewhere as a different but still ordinary level item. And then he suggests that it can be modified by working with the thoughts. And we'll look at that in a moment, see if we can practice with it for a couple of minutes. But right now, let's just get clear on that part. The focal setting, mind as focal setting, is not something that you find within mind. It's and that's kind of obvious if you think about the image of focal setting. You know, if you're looking in a microscope and you change the focal setting, different things come into focus. But you know, no matter what comes into focus, no matter how often you change the focal setting, you're never going to find the focal setting itself. Right? That's what allows you to experience different kinds of things, and that really is a function that is very close to the function of the field. Whatever shows up in the field, and the field is a function of what shows up, but what shows up is also a function of the field. The two are really inseparable from one another. Whatever shows up in the field is, whatever it is, it's not the field. The field is the possibility of something showing up. So the field gets much closer to the allowing quality of space and the allowing quality of mind. That's what we're really exploring. And the same thing is true of the focal setting. It gives access to new possibilities. Now, I like the language of field. Personally, I like it a little better than focal setting because the language of focal setting still makes it sound like you're at a distance. You're observing something. And because you've changed the focal setting, you can now observe something different. So I think a couple of weeks ago, I'm not sure I actually said this, it may just have been in my notes, but when we were working with the notion of focal setting a couple of weeks back, I was thinking, the model or the image is of somebody using a camera or a microscope or some image like that and changing the focal setting of this device. But really, to understand what's being suggested, I think you have to think of yourself as being the device, being the microscope, being the camera, and the focal setting shifts. And actually, when it shifts, the camera shifts too. It's not like, we tend to think, oh, well, the camera's the same, but we just made a little adjustment on the camera. But if you think of the camera as a mechanism, changing the focal setting changes the whole camera. So he says, yeah, the metaphor is kind of mechanical. And that's right. I mean, I think it's a very useful metaphor, and people have gotten a whole lot of benefit from it. But I actually, I like the image of the field. It seems to me to open up in other or additional ways. But I'm not trying to say, they serve somewhat different functions, even though they point in the same direction. Michael adds to that, he says, field sounds like an inclusive realm of possibilities. Focal setting sounds like one dedicated viewpoint. That's right. But of course, the reason focal setting is introduced is precisely to point out that there's more than one dedicated viewpoint. But it still sounds like, well, just one at a time. Whereas in field, the range of possibilities that's available is greater. Let's look at the other part of that sentence that I was just quoting. So the field itself, or rather the focal setting itself, can't be located as an item within what you see. And then he goes on to say, the mind as focal setting understanding is helpful because we can modify it by working with the thoughts, with the content. Let me see here. So Hayward says, sort of in defense of focal setting, the concept of focal setting allows for a shifting field. Yeah, okay, that's a nice way to play with those two things. And of course, for those, I mean, people hardly ever work with that kind of camera anymore. But the point of changing the focal setting in a lot of cases was to change the depth of field. I mean, that's the language that was used. So the two are very closely related. I think that's a good point. David asks a question about the not. And I'm just not going to try to answer that right now, David, because I think it would take us too far afield. But I will try to answer it in the orientation that I do for next week. We were trying to do a little work with the not. I tried to say something about that in the last orientation. So I'm going to treat this as a question about that, and we'll try to get to it later. If by some chance the chat box is not saved, because I don't actually know how to do that, David, could you put that in an email to me separately, and then I'll respond to it. Okay, so I was going to try to give us a couple of minutes looking at this possibility of what it would mean to work directly with thoughts. Let me suggest doing it this way. Let's try to do this for a couple of minutes. We won't have much time for comment, but now it is. So we're working with thoughts, but at some point, I don't think it'll be in this session, but at some point we have to talk more about thoughts. And the nature, what is the relationship of a thought to a field? I mean, if a thought is an object, then it's a black hole in the way that I was saying before. But the fascinating thing about thoughts and why they're so engaging is that they have their own fields. What I'm imagining when I say that, or what I'm thinking of, is that, you think of something and it kind of plays itself out. It's like this little movie that runs through your mind. And in order for that to happen, it's like you have to create a little world in the thought. So that's complicated and creates certain problems. So it's too complicated, I think, to deal with right now. What I would rather deal with instead is the kind of identity, the kind of thought that shows up in mind, which is really more like an identifying thought. So, you know, I look at the clock and I know it's a clock, and that's a thought. You know, that's what I'd like to use as a thought. So more related to perception. So pure perception, if we can imagine that there is pure perception for a moment, is something like seeing a red patch, you know. But the moment you see that red patch as being a tomato, now you've got a thought element. So that's the kind of thought I'd like to work with, just because it's simpler. So the basic idea is this. If you look around, probably seeing is the easiest way, looking at things, but you could try hearing or thoughts, just tricky with thoughts. Thoughts in the more expanded sense. So as you look around, whatever the object is that you encounter, let it expand into its field. So this is like expanding and condensing. It's more targeted at the relationship between the object and the field. So the idea here is that every object, even though when we identify it as an object, we kind of shrink it down to a particular identity, but every object shows up within the field of space, within this field of its space, you could say. And that's what I thought we could explore for just a couple of minutes. Boy, it's a little late. But let's try it for a couple of minutes anyway. So I hope that's sufficiently clear. In other words, you're looking at something, there's a file cabinet in front of me, and okay, I know it's a file cabinet, but I can let the file cabinet expand into its field. And that may be the room, but it may be my sense of what's in the file cabinet. It may be things that I can't really name. But every object has its field. And as you go into the field, you really tend to lose the focus on the object. So that's a way of exploring. That's just one way of working with this idea that you're shifting the focal setting in the direction of a field. So let's try doing that just for a couple of minutes now, okay? I think we'll have to stop after we've done it, but at least let's have the experience of doing it. Okay, a couple of minutes. Okay, so I'm not going to try to take comments on that because we're out of time. But by all means, continue it on the website, the discussion, and I'll look in on the website this week and see if there are things that I think I can contribute to. Hopefully, I will. I'll say a little bit in the orientation about some things we didn't get to in this reading, even though it was quite short. There's always so much to say about each of these readings. There's always so many ideas. So we'll go on next week and we read a little further in the TSK book. We jump ahead a bit. So maybe some of these same themes will come up. Okay, thanks very much, everybody.